Episode 30, December the 27th, 2009. Professor Barry Jones. Hello and welcome to AstroTalk UK. ATUK is a not-for-profit amateur astronomy podcast produced by me, Gurbir Singh, an amateur astronomer based in the UK. For more information, see the About and FAQ pages at www.astrotalkuk.org. 30 years ago, a revolutionary higher education institution for adults was established in the UK. Students enrolled in the Open University 2 years later in 1971. This model of higher education has now spread across the globe. Today, the Open University plays a strong and active role in the exploration of space in collaboration with ESA and NASA. The first bit of human technology.
And I was working very happily on that. We'd emigrated, so I could have actually stayed there, you know, forever. My wife was very happy there as forthcoming head of a Montessori school. I was following the emergence of the OU and the development of it and the launch of it in the airmail edition of The Guardian. In those days, there wasn't the internet.
Right.
The best you could have was
the
airmail edition of The Guardian. Yeah. And also, it seemed to me that you could make an impact in teaching to more than just 30 students a year. You know, you were talking to hundreds of students spread around the UK and ultimately beyond. Hmm. And that really attracted me, so I applied for a lectureship that was advertised in physics. And there were 180 applicants, and I got it.
The Open University courses that I remember you being associated with, very influential in the early days, were the S101, ST291, S256, and that's why it's such a special personal privilege to talk to you today. I did all of those,
yeah.
And I'm sure you did many others, but the OU, in addition to science, was successful with the arts, other sciences, mm-hmm. law. Why do you think that model of teaching was so successful in the end?
I think it's because a huge amount of effort went into supported self-learning. There are a lot of correspondence colleges out who basically sent out rather second-rate material, often in TypeScript, mm-hmm. And there was very little backup. Whereas the OU was determined to get away from that model. We have properly produced materials, published often nowadays in full colour, thoroughly produced by a course team and for many drafts, lots of discussions of the education strategy, good science editors, high quality products, but then there's the follow-up. We have the associate lecturers who had their own little cohort of 20 or 30 students to look after during the year, and nowadays respond by email and the phone, but particularly email. In those days, in the early days, of course, we didn't have DVDs and CDs and so on, and so we had radio programs and television programs, which are quite famous these days.
Oh, I remember. Yes.
and later on, of course, the system evolved with just as much student support, I believe, as we had in the early days. But nowadays, you have more electronic contact with your tutor than before. And now, instead of having broadcast television, we now issue DVDs or have stuff on the internet.
Right. Yes, you're right. You know, despite the fact that you've got the internet now that you didn't have then, I think then, because of it, you have much more personal contact,
yes.
Whether it's the Saturday morning lectures or
yes.
once in an evening in a month, and of course the famous summer schools.
Yeah, of course they continue. The summer schools are extremely important. Yeah.
The Open University today is associated with many of the well-known projects, for example, Beagle 2, Stardust, Rosetta, Cassini-Huygens, Genesis, Mars Express. That's quite a remarkable achievement for a fairly new kid on the block type institution.
Mm.
How has it achieved that?
Fairly gradually. Early on, research was really put on the back burner for teaching, in favor of teaching, because we had to get our teaching program established. And really, it's really been an explosion in the last 15 or 20 years. At the end of my 3 years, we had grown a bit, but the important thing was we were on a growth spurt. and we were really rising up. And the same was true in the sciences. We captured some very good groups early on. We got Colin Pillage and his group, then we got the University of Kent group and John Zarnecki and others. KEPSAR is the Centre for Earth, Space Science and Astronomical Research. So KEPSAR has now got literally hundreds of people in it, if you include all categories of staff and students.
Ah. Are there any projects that are in the pipeline that perhaps we don't know yet about yet?
There's the Mars sample return. We're also involved with what's called DARWIN, which is an infrared space telescope consisting of several apertures flying in space. And that's very exciting. It may not go up for 10 years or thereabouts, but it will have the capability of getting an image as a dot of light of a nearby planet orbiting another star and actually see the image of the star itself as a dot of light, which is practically impossible at the moment.
Over the last decade, a lot of new research areas have blossomed. For example, astrobiology, astropaleobiology, astrochemistry, research into exoplanets and SETI. A couple of decades ago, a scientist in these areas would have been shunned, but now he'd be actively supported. What do you reckon is the reason behind this cultural shift?
Yes, certainly to be interested in life beyond the Earth, even a respectable place to look like Mars, was considered to be a little bit fanciful. Certainly SETI has long been considered to be fanciful. Really, this subject took off in 1996 when the first planet around another star, 51 Pegasi, is the star. We now know over 300 planets.
Although you're retired, you have an immense interest in astrobiology. Are you still actively involved in research?
Yes, I am. I retired in 2006. In fact, what it's meant is that I'm not involved in Open University teaching anymore, but I do have a postdoctoral research fellow who joined me the day after I retired and will be with me for several years to come, I hope. He's very good, Jonty Horner. And we've been working on planets around other stars, exoplanetary systems, a continuing work I was doing from about 1998 when I started to look at exoplanetary systems and ask the question, well, look, we can detect the giants up there. We can't detect the Earths because they're too little and they don't have an effect on their star. And so we postulated the following question. Well, given that we know where some giants are on actual systems, could we put an Earth-like planet in the habitable zone, which is in a zone around the star, which is neither too hot nor too cold for liquid water, because all life as we know it. And so we did computer models to see whether planets could survive in orbits in the habitable zone or might be ejected by the gravity of the giant. I've written a book. I've just produced a book, The Search for Life Continued, Planets Around Other Stars, which is my first attempt at the popular science shelf, but I have several textbooks out on the solar system and also on life in the universe. So I'm still fairly active.
In 2006, you were the recipient of the David Wynne Williams Prize for services to astrobiology in the UK.
Yes.
How do you feel about that?
I was gobsmacked. I had no idea I was going to get that. I went to their conference at Kent, the second conference they had at the University of Kent at Canterbury. And I was sitting there at the conference dinner, and I think it was Mark Burchard said, now we're going to announce the prize winner of the David Williams inaugural prize, just been set up. And the winner is, and I thought it was Barry Jones. Is this right? And so I was very, very pleased, to get that.
Well, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Very briefly, what's your view on panspermia? Specifically, the evidence over the last decade or two, has it increased for that for panspermia or decreased?
Interesting. I was talking to Chandrawick Ramasinghe, at Cardiff. I said to him, look, you've calculated the probability of all these bits and pieces coming together to form the first cell to be negligibly small. It would never happen on the Earth.
Right.
And so I suppose, and his case is that given the volume of space within a few hundred light years of us, there's a lot more space for these unlikely events to
Okay.
I said, look, I think that what you're doing is saying, well, we're going to assemble this one bit at a time. Mm-hmm. What about a hierarchical assembly? Like you have a little cluster here, mm-hmm. and a little cluster there, and these two little clusters come together. Mm-hmm. And I completely misunderstood him, I think, because he said, no, we don't do it like that. We've included that. If you have little clusters of interesting biomolecules that come together like that, then you can greatly reduce the improbability. It becomes more probable.
Right.
And he'd actually taken that into his considerations. Oh. And he still came up with this astronomically low probability of life having emerged on the Earth. Now, I haven't redone the calculations, so I'm not sure. He's a good theoretician. So I think that the case for panspermia, if what he's saying is correct, is more compelling than I thought it was. He offers a solution by saying, well, there's a lot more space and time out there than there is on the Earth. So these improbable events can occur, and life can then come to us.
So jury's still out, still a possibility.
Oh, the jury's still out. And I think, in my own mind, I've given them a bit more credence now than I did before.
Okay. And finally, Professor, as you said, you've written several books, the most recent of which is The Search for Life Continued. If you speculate into the next 10 years or so, what sort of discoveries do you think are around the corner in terms of life and extraterrestrial intelligence?
Yes, well, of course, I think in terms of the discovery of life, we don't know what Mars sample returns are going to deliver. Will there be fossils discovered a meter or so below the Martian surface? Will there be microbes even? Who knows? It's unlikely but possible. Regarding planets, I think that once we've got Darwin up, it's quite possible we'll have detected an Earth-like planet and imaged it, got its spectrum, and it's possible we will have detected a habitable planet. When it's got the right conditions, maybe even evidence of life possible in the next 10 to 15 years. With SETI, well, you never know. It's one of these things. It's highly unlikely that today you're going to discover a signal, or even in the next 10 years. But if we do, it'll be of the most extraordinary consequence, mm-hmm. that it's worth spending relatively small sums of money in this improbable venture. The next decade or two is going to be one of the most exciting decades in our quest for extraterrestrial life.
Professor Barry Jones, thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome.
As the UK government recently announced further cuts in the higher education budget, today's quote is from Derek Bock. If you think education is expensive, try ignorance.